Chapter 6. Philip showed up in Vancouver only a week after he had talked to Steve Caputa and rested for a day while he arranged for a town car to get Steve. They met in the lobby of Philip's hotel and walked toward the hotel's restaurant for a late lunch. Stephen was older than Philip had expected. Not nearly as old as Philip, but at least 35. From the name Seminary Steve, he had presumed that Steve was in his 20s. He had a mature look, honest, slightly confused, but sincere and mature. He was obviously Italian, with curly black hair and an olive complexion, just about Philip's height and solidly built. "I am very glad to meet you, Steve." Steve returned the greeting. "I take it you're hungry after the long ride." Philip turned toward the restaurant, and they began walking slowly in that direction. "Well, I guess I am, Philip. Thank you." The hotel was modern and designed primarily for business travelers. There was a reasonably good restaurant and a large bar. There was also a large open area with clusters of chairs and couches, which many of the guests used for informal meetings. Philip had chosen this hotel primarily because he enjoyed being around business travelers. They tended to be polite, engaging, and busy enough with their own affairs that they didn't intrude into yours. The restaurant was nearly empty at the time they entered, which made for a relaxed, slow meal with plenty of time to talk. "I've got to tell you, Steve, I am pleasantly surprised that you are not a very young man." Steve smiled. "Yeah, I'm definitely one of the older students." He paused for a moment. "Exactly why are you glad I'm older?" Philip had been piecing his thoughts together, more or less automatically, as they made their way to the table, and now he had the pieces together. "Oh, I just find a certain level of maturity is much better for understanding difficult subjects. And I'm sure we'll be discussing some rather important things before we're done." Steve smiled a slightly conspiratorial smile. "Of that I have no doubt." They both laughed quietly, each beginning to feel comfortable with the other. "And I know what you mean about maturity. About every 5 years I look backwards and say to myself, my God, I'm so much farther along now than I was then." Philip was happy to see that Steve was not only honest, but self-analytical. As they looked at their menus, Philip realized something else that was making him happy. With Steve, he could talk in scriptural terms. James and the others, for all their brilliance, didn't have the same biblical vocabulary base that he would have with Steve. "You're smiling quite a bit there, Prester. Anything particular?" "Yeah, there is, but please call me Philip. I can talk scripturese with you, Steve. I have almost no one else that would understand me. You don't mind, do you?" Steve knew what Philip meant. "No, I don't mind at all. Go right ahead." Philip nearly giggled. "Okay. I was thinking about you saying that you look back and analyze yourself every now and then. Way back in my early days, that was the one lesson I worked hardest on. And I'm convinced that it was the thing that kept me moving forward, while so many others fell by the wayside." "So what was it that got through to you? Commune with thine own heart? Or he seeketh truth in the inner parts?" "Yes, both of those, plus a few others. Boy, it's been a long time, but I can still remember where I was when I made my complete commitment to self-honesty. I can tell you where I was standing in the room and the time of day." "And what was it you said?" Philip stopped. "How do you know I said anything? Maybe I just decided." Steve smiled. "With the mouth, confession is made unto salvation. You certainly would have said it, not just thought it." "Well, you're right," I said. "I will face the truth and not turn away from it. In my heart, in my mind, I will face the truth, whatever it is." And I meant it with every ounce of strength I possessed. Philip stopped and looked at Steve. "You know what I mean when I say I not only said it, but that I spoke it into being, don't you, Steve?"
"Yes, Philip, I do."
Philip looked at Steve sincerely, knowing where this conversation would be leading. "Steve, no matter what we talk about over the next few days, I want you to know that I value spiritual experiences highly, and I do not oppose them." So, how did you get into the Bible, Steve?
Well, I was a kid during the charismatic days, and my older brother used to bring me to the meetings.
Whoa, in the charismatic days? How old were you?
Maybe 8.
Oh my God, that was my world. Where was this?
Well, we lived in upstate New York, near Ithaca.
No. Don't tell me your brother went to the Love Inn.
Steve's face lit up.
Yes, you know the Love Inn?
Philip laughed so loudly that a few people in the restaurant turned to see what was so funny.
Yeah, I knew a bunch of people who used to go there. How long did you go?
Not long, I mean. I was only about 10 when everyone split up. My brother moved away right at the time also, so I didn't go to any more meetings for quite some time. Much to my mother's relief, I might add.
Yeah, I know. The whole charismatic thing was very difficult for the parents. They were coming out of an age of conformity, and here were their kids doing things that were different to the point of appearing dangerous. And to be honest, most of us did a really shitty job of explaining things to the parents. We brought a lot of it on ourselves.
Philip had used the word shitty purposefully. He wanted to be sure that Steve wasn't going to get bent out of shape if he spoke freely. Steve never flinched.
What happened after your brother moved and you stopped going to meetings?
Oh, I mostly returned to normal. I got busy with baseball, football, and school. Then girls, of course. Really, I didn't read the Bible much more till I was about 20.
But I had been rather dramatically healed one night at a meeting, and had felt the powers of the Spirit very strongly. I guess I never entirely forgot it.
Anyway, I took the whole summer off of school when I was about 20 and got an evening job at UPS. It was 4 hours per night, and paid me enough to live at the dormitory. I had been wanting to pick up the Bible again, and I stayed into it all summer long.
And then?
Oh, I went back to school, but I studied whenever I could and tried all sorts of meetings. I've only been taking classes at UW for a couple of semesters, and part-time at that. My real job is accounting.
Philip began to look very sad. And through all your searchings, you never found anything that was as pure and shining as what you found in the New Testament, did you?
Now Steve looked equally as sad.
No, I never did. Maybe for a short period of time, but that's all.
Once they had a breakthrough, they seemed doomed to sink down again. It was uncanny. As soon as something good happened, something swept right in behind it and neutralized it. There was real pain in Steve's eyes, the residue of many deep disappointments.
Yes, I understand, Steve. I know.
Then Philip brightened halfway and took on a look of deep determination. He spoke passionately, but quietly.
Steve, I know why. I know what's killing the life.
Steve had given up on figuring it out. He had never expected to hear those words in this life.
You're serious? Yes, I am. But it's a long and difficult explanation, and there's not a simple 5-word answer. It's more like assembling piece after piece, and then, suddenly, you can see the big picture. Would you be able to go through a long, hard process?
Steve looked him dead in the eye.
I think I'd be willing to die for it.
By mid-July, economic figures from the second quarter of the year were being assembled in U.S. government offices in Washington and New York. There was now no question about it. The uncontrolled internet economy was seriously cutting into government revenues. Reports flew from office to office, and the NSA was urgently ordered to address the situation. The NSA report estimated that between 2 and 4 million Americans were conducting private commerce through the Gamma systems. Yet after 2 years, they had been able to trace only 10 of them. And even those were only traceable because they had been very sloppy. The system was now large and growing steadily. The public prosecutions of a few Gamma people had not had much of an effect. In general, it seemed to have made people more careful, but did not keep them away. By putting the economic figures together with the NSA report, analysts were led to the conclusion that it was the wealthiest and most productive who were hiding their business from the government. If the NSA was correct that only a few million Americans were involved, the revenue losses could only have been caused by medium and large earners removing themselves from the system. The best cash cows were running away, and the NSA didn't know how to stop them. Some officials wanted to shut down the internet altogether. but they were ultimately convinced that such an action would not only undermine their public image, but would be akin to financial suicide. The internet now was so much a part of American economic life that trying to destroy it would cause such an enormous loss of commerce that it would probably throw half of the world into a depression. Others wanted to hunt down the people involved and throw them into jail, or even execute them for treason. Given the distributed nature of the enterprise, however, this would have almost no overall effect on private commerce. Anyone who wanted it could open a cyber market. Trying to hack into all the Gamma networks was another option, but it had already been tried at length with little success. The final option was posed by a senior analyst at the CIA. She proposed a one-country, two-system compromise with the Gamma markets. In this scheme, normal commerce and income would be subjected to the existing methods of taxation, and people doing business through the Gamma markets would be convinced to pay a flat 10% of their income to the US government. Initial memos between the US government and the governments of the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the European Union indicated that all of these governments would also be interested in such a plan. The difficulty, of course, would lie in convincing the Gamma markets to be taxed. They began developing strategies. Back in Lycée, Jim and Francis were getting back to a somewhat normal life. They had live-in help, a college girl from Slovenia, working for a year to earn tuition money. Mostly, she did the household chores while Francis took care of the baby, although she did watch Emily if Jim and Francis went out for an evening. It had taken Francis 3 months to recover from the delivery. She was never really sick, just desperately tired and surprised by the difficulty of the whole affair. But now she was almost back to normal and eager to have her friends and relatives visit. One group at a time, they would meet in Paris or Antwerp, then drive to Lycée. Jim bought a large sport utility vehicle for this purpose. Because of the difficulty of bringing people in, they had to be careful, with Jim obviously on a lot of government lists. These visits tended to be long rather than frequent. This actually proved to be very rewarding. Jim got to know Francis's friends and family very well, and vice versa. Instead of a single day, they would actually live together for one or more weeks. In so doing, they really got to know each other. Talks in the kitchen till 2 in the morning, drives into Amsterdam for special groceries, midnight runs to the nearest coffee shop and get some work done. In the course of 2 weeks, people who had never met before knew each other quite well. Both Francis and Jim decided that this would be their preferred way of getting to know people. George? Who's calling, please?
George, it's me, Michael Anderson.
Michael, how did you know to call me here?
Michael smiled, understanding that finding George when he didn't wish to be found was nearly impossible.
Bill McCoy helped me.
I see.
Well, what's up, Michael? This must be important.
Michael paused just a moment before speaking.
George, I think you might want to come back to the lab for a while. We've got some very interesting things happening.
Mike, you know I left the lab on purpose.
Yes, I do, said Michael.
But while he was sure that taking a break from the lab was good for George, Michael also suspected that neurochemistry was still deeply important to him. Besides, their new discoveries were important, and they needed George to review them.
Hear me out, George. Something important is happening.
All right, Michael, I'll listen. George's curiosity was beginning to show. More importantly, Michael thought he sensed a sort of paternal protection in his voice.
George, we began looking at natural changes in the human psyche. We wanted to find more information on the body's change mechanisms.
Yes, I remember.
Right. Well, we took a hard look at pregnancy, perhaps the most potent period of change in any human life.
Now George's mind became very active, imagining where this was going.
And you found something new, didn't you?
Yes, George, we did. Michael paused for just a moment and continued.
We found huge changes in the mother's neurochemistry and a new group of neuropeptides.
George had expected Michael's words. It was something he had considered years before. But the fact that this was now real, not just speculation, still surprised him.
Continue, Michael. Very well. The first experiments were conducted on a group of French women. All that was required was to collect blood samples. As their pregnancies developed,
we began to see a rise in the levels of free neuropeptides in the blood. The first surprise was that there were a lot of them, more than we'd expected. The second surprise was that they were of a different type. So to clear things up, we took a few small tissue samples from the next group of mothers. Michael stopped. And, Michael, what? He took a deep breath. George, we found that the extra neuropeptides were not being manufactured. They were coming loose from the mother's body cells. Michael paused, and George's mind went into a sort of overdrive. But that would mean, he began thinking and finished by mumbling, that the mother's body was releasing those peptides into the bloodstream. Michael, what about the fetus and the baby? Did the babies pick up the peptides? Michael spoke in his most serious voice. Yes, George, they did. That was the final experiment that led me to call you. Holy shit, this is huge! Can you come to Paris, George? George didn't respond right away. He was alternating between the ramifications of what Michael had just said and what would be required of him to leave Taiwan, where he had been for a few months. Yes, I can come, Michael. Give me a few days to close up shop here and I'll be there as soon as I can. George Demetrius actually left Taipei the following morning. A local friend saw to the loose ends he left behind. On his three flights to France, George made pages of notes. The questions seemed unending. What was it that would make the mother's cellular receptors loosen? This was a new mechanism, and probably a lot more elegant than using chemicals to break peptides. Then could this be why women have an unusual vibrancy during pregnancy? With millions of peptides being released for the first time in years, might this be like taking the Breakers treatment, only more so? And then, what of the peptides transmitted to the fetus? Is this how some hereditary characteristics are passed along? And if indeed the structure of the subconscious is chemical, is this mother-to-child transmission the first formation of the subconscious mind? How much of this transmission would be harmful? How much necessary? George slept little on his way to France, which left him seriously jet-lagged by the time he arrived. He slept on and off for 3 days at the hotel close to the lab, spending only a few hours each day observing the work. In his weary moments, he wondered if he was getting sucked back into something he had rightly left behind. But when his energy was normal, he knew that this was necessary and that it would not be permanent. How Francis found out about the new developments in the Breakers lab was at first a mystery to Michael. Eventually, he learned that McCoy had been talking to Jim and that the information was passed along that way. Francis was back to strength now, with Emily almost weaned, and she was her usual demanding self, having come across knowledge that she wanted. Michael, I want you to send me your research findings. I promise that I won't let anyone else see them, but I need them. Why, Francis, what do you need? She waited for just a moment, thinking about what exactly she should say. Because, Michael, I think it's important for my daughter, and because I'm about to get pregnant again. Michael smiled, remembering the importance of never coming between a mother and her children. All right, Francis, I can get the information to you, but I should also tell you that we wouldn't even consider trying Breakers on a pregnant woman, not without a lot more research. Okay, Michael, but why? Because the mechanisms are far too complex, Francis. Some of the peptides we break may be important for the baby. We cannot tinker with immensely complicated processes, especially when a baby is involved. We are a long, long way from being able to do that sort of thing. It would be grossly incompetent. He was about to say something about misdeveloped babies, but that is not something that should be said to an expectant mother. So, are you planning on getting pregnant soon? Yes, I am, Mike. Her voice sounded cheery now. But don't tell anyone. No, of course not. Anyway, Emily is starting to walk, and I'm feeling good. We want one more child, and we really shouldn't wait. I'm 36, you know? Oh, I didn't know. I would have guessed a bit younger. You're very kind, Michael. Anyway, we're ready to get started on our second now, and I want every health benefit possible for my child. Oh, I understand, Francis, but we simply can't rush into something like that. He stopped, thinking about another angle. I'll tell you what, though. might be a great experiment to administer a new version of our protocol to you after childbirth.
And why is that?
Because with all of your receptors loosened during pregnancy, we could break up a lot of the peptides before they become lodged into your receptors again.
And this would require one of you coming up for the delivery, staying for a week or two?
Yes, but I'm getting ahead of myself, Francis. Michael realized that he had gone a bit too far in his excitement over the new experiment. I really need to run some animal experiments first, to support the idea that it can be done safely, although it shouldn't be a problem.
Do your experiments, Michael. I'll send you money if necessary, but I want to do this.
And I want you to look into the administration of breakers to children. Why should they be saddled with a painful subconscious during childhood if it isn't necessary? Youth is hard enough anyway.
Michael agreed and assigned two researchers to the task. Also to send her details of the experiment as they came available.
Oh, and Michael.
Oh, she sounded cheerful again, almost childlike.
Yes, Francis, what is it that you are about to ask?
Well, Mr. Confirmed Bachelor, I've been hearing stories about you and a certain French lady.
How about it, Mike? I'm telling you the intimate details of my reproductive plans. How about you telling me yours,
Although she had no way of seeing, Francis knew that Michael was blushing deeply. Also that he was feeling his usual privacy and restraint.
Come on, Michael, tell Sister Francis.
All right, you win this one.
Yes, I'm getting pretty serious with one of the researchers here. Her name is Chloe. I actually took her back to the States to meet my family.
Oh, this is serious. So what now? And when do I get to meet her?
He laughed. Okay, I'll bring her to meet you soon. And we'll probably get married in a few months.
Oh, congratulations, Michael. She must be special. Are you thinking about kids?
Thanks, Francis. And yes, we are thinking about kids in a few years.
Good. Oh, I need to get back to Emily.
He laughed again. Go ahead, Francis. And I will send you that material as soon as possible. And I'll plan on coming up with Chloe for you after delivery treatment.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Philip's conversation with Steve Caputa lasted nearly 3 days, during which time they shared meals and took long walks through Vancouver. The discussions were probably more difficult for Philip than they were for Steve, but they had gone very well. Philip expressed his opinions without restraint, and Steve understood. It was certainly far too much for Stephen to agree to all at once, but he was able to retain Philip's ideas and to consider them at length. On the morning of their third day together, Steve told Philip that he needed to get back to Seattle. Philip thought that was a good idea, as he had already covered everything he needed to. He had gotten to the core of it with Steve, and Steve had grasped it. Certainly it would take him some time to sort through all of the ideas Philip had thrown upon him, but he was able to understand and retain them. Philip waited in the lobby while Steve checked out and gathered his luggage. He picked up a newspaper, caught up on the events of the past days. He would stay one more night and head east in the morning. As yet, he wasn't sure where he'd go, and he didn't much care, as long as he had a nice place to relax for a few days. Steve picked up a paper of his own, and they sat on the lobby's chair, reading their papers and relaxing. Steve was in no rush to leave, and sitting for a while seemed nice. After about 10 minutes, Steve lowered his paper.
Philip, do you know anything about this private commerce stuff?
Philip was surprised and slightly concerned.
Why?
Well, I was just reading a story about it, and I got the clear impression that you had something to do with it. Does that sound crazy?
Philip smiled and resigned himself to telling Steve that he was right. After all, he couldn't talk about insights for 3 days and then shut the man down as soon as he had one.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. I do.
I knew it!
Apparently so.
Steve spoke quietly now, knowing that Philip wouldn't want anyone passing by to hear.
Tell me about it.
Well, I didn't really create them or anything, but I encouraged and helped the people who did.
So are they going to succeed?
Yeah, I think so. They're not entirely out of danger yet, but I think they'll make it.
Jeez, this is great. Can you get me in?
Sure, I'll send you a link. But remember, you have to follow all of the security protocols we give you. If you don't,
You'll put yourself and everyone else at risk.
I can do that, but tell me, why did you do it in the first place? It was a big risk, wasn't it?
Oh yes, it was. But ultimately, the risks paled compared to the rewards. A lot of the developers were computer industry people, and for them it was just a natural progression. Me, I reached a conclusion that people will never evolve very far spiritually until they get beyond the agricultural era version of God and spirituality. So long as the agricultural God is enthroned in people's minds, they are limited. But to make that kind of a break, you have to find a way to get away from agricultural rulers and their systems of servitude. That required a way to live separate and apart from them. They'll never just leave you alone.
Wow,
Steve seemed impressed. But then he started laughing to himself.
What is it?
Philip was intrigued. Now Steve laughed out loud.
All right, Philip, talk scripture to me. What was the scripture that you were thinking about during this process? There had to be one.
Now Philip was laughing as well.
You're a smart guy, Steve. Jeremiah 9.
Oh, that my head were waters, and mine eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of my people. Philip paused, and Steve finished the quote. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them. Steve looked down for a moment, then lifted his head and spoke.
So your objective was to build a lodging place for the productive and the noble?
Yes, a place where they could develop, a haven. Steve paused for a moment, then spoke again.
Philip, I've seen you with a worried look on your face more than once. What is it?
He smiled. Until now, I worried about destroying the ancient paths, that people couldn't take the truth without a myth to make it acceptable, to get beyond their guilt and shame.
And what made you change your mind?
You did, Steve.
Me? What did I do?
You understood, and you didn't buckle under the load.
Philip, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I'm not sure that you're right.
He smiled. No, I don't think that you do, Steve. But you could understand me and allow my ideas to exist as possibilities in your mind and to remain. In some ways, Steve was opposed to some of Philip's ideas and uncertain of many others. But at the same time, he knew somewhere deep within himself that he would eventually agree with them. The feeling was tucked away on the edge of his consciousness, but he knew that it was telling him the truth. That there was too much obstruction for Philip's ideas to move to the center of his consciousness now, but that they would eventually get there. It was as if the idea had caught his attention, winked at their secret, and gone back into its cove. Somehow he knew that the idea itself would slowly clear debris out of its path and take its place in a clearer and better mind. Philip looked happy, if a bit subdued as well.
One final point, Steve.
Go on.
The things I believe don't really depend on Jesus or the existence of God. If it turns out that there never was a Jesus and that all of his ideas impute to him are just my romantic notion, my ideas still stand. Jesus, to me, is a probable point of origin for a great synthesis. But he doesn't make or break anything. Maybe I'm holding to Jesus to get me out of some philosophical door, just like the Sola Scriptura guys held to the scriptures. It is possible, you know, but I am sure that my ideas hold up, Jesus or no.
So, Philip, all that being said, do you or do you not believe in life after death?
Personally, I do expect that life continues beyond physical death. But I'm basing that on my own subjective experiences more than I am on hard evidence. I've had experiences that led me to believe that I'm considerably more than only my body, and that this essence of me is not subject to death. In addition, there is a little bit of evidence from near-death experiences to support such an idea. This evidence is far from conclusive, but it does exist. So I'd say yes, I expect to continue living past physical death, but I have quite incomplete evidence. It was now time for Steve to leave. Philip walked him out to his car, where they embraced and agreed to stay in touch.
Max, I want to get out of this entirely and get as far away from here as possible.
John Morales, sitting in Max's private office, was stone-faced and harshly serious. Max thought to himself that the young man had matured significantly in the past year and a half.
All right, John. I'll get Barry on it immediately. But would you please tell me why?
Because I'm helping them too much, Max. Jones is getting more powerful, and my work is helping him. He has already conducted raids on a number of innocent people. Some of them weren't involved in Gamma at all, and one man is already dead from a raid gone bad.
The one in Dallas?
Yes. Hang on. Max picked up his desk telephone and called Anthony Barry.
Tony, Morales wants out.
And now? Max listened for a moment, then turned to Morales.
John, Barry says that it's almost an all-or-nothing situation for you. If you want out, you leave the United States. Is that what you want?
John Morales had known that this day would come for some time. That made it easier, but only partially. This was the choice he had wished to avoid. 2 years ago, he wouldn't have been able to stand up to it. But now, difficult though it was, he was ready. For one thing, he had seen what following the rules had done to Tim Nicholson, his friend since college. Nicholson had spent the past 2 years moving up in the FBI organization. He followed their rules and benefited, moving up quickly, even after failing to get much information on Gamma. He and Jones were now a team, and they were important people in the organization. But Tim no longer thought about the results of what he did. If it was in accordance with the rules, he wanted to hear no more about it, almost as if his mind had been assimilated into a system itself. It seemed to John that a part of Tim's soul had died, or at least gone into hiding. In one way, he was saddened by it. But in another way, he had come too close to being like Tim. He didn't want to see it anymore. And Jones, he thought. Jones died years ago. Max was right. Jones had been a good guy when he was young. It was really institutional life that had killed his soul. His need for respect combined with a system that rewards a person for conformity and for promotion of the system, rather than for goodness and ability.
I'm ready to do it, Max, he said. I can leave.
Max spoke briefly to Barry and then said goodbye.
All right, John. We'll do this now. I presume you have an anonymous email address?
Sure, I have a bunch of them.
Good.
Max pulled a piece of paper out of his drawer and wrote something on it.
Here's Barry's address. Write him tonight, and you do whatever he says. Understand?
You bet I do, Max. John knew that Max was about to give him the young man pep talk. He appreciated Max's paternal care for him, but also felt that he had outgrown it. He preempted him.
And don't tell me about being careful, Max. I appreciate your concern, but this isn't my first time anymore. I'll be very careful, and I'll do what Barry says.
He smiled at Max.
Okay?
Max understood.
Yeah, kid, that's okay.
He patted John on the back and hugged him before he left the office.
John, here's the plan. First, say nothing to anyone about this. Second, I'm setting you up with a new identity. You'll owe me for this later, including a bank account, ID, and credit card. Drop off some passport photos at my office ASAP. Third, you will buy a cheap car before you leave and register the title in your own name. Then you will leave on a Friday afternoon and drive to Canada, crossing the border on the road to Vancouver. If asked, you're going to Vancouver to meet friends. From there, you will drive to Montreal, where you will catch a flight to Paris. We have friends there. Fourth, I will have your new ID and accounts ready in 2 to 3 weeks, and you should leave almost immediately thereafter. Don't do anything unusual at FBI. Do nothing that could trigger any attention.
Fifth, regarding your future, by now you must know all about the team of hackers protecting Gamma. These people would love to have you work with them. If you'd like, I can put you in touch with them.
That's all for now. Get those photos to me right away, and remember to act normally.
don't start selling off your stuff. If you need to store anything, ask Martin to handle it. I'll let him know what you're up to. Bari. Although it was early summer, the weather in eastern Canada was chilly and windy. Philip had made his way to Sydney by plane, with a one-night stopover in Toronto, where he spent the evening with one of his son-in-laws, who was working there for the week. Philip checked into the Windsor Hotel in Sydney 2 full days before he was supposed to show up at Skunk 2 and forced himself to rest completely. He stayed in bed half the time, ordered room service for his meals, and even had a masseur come in one day. Although his health was excellent, Philip was now well into his 50s. He knew that this was a critical point in life. If he took good care of himself now, repairing the stress damage of his earlier years and rebuilding his reserves, he could live a very long, very active life. But he had pushed his limits far too often all the way into his 50s. If he had kept it up only a few more years, the damage would have been irreversible. The next morning, Philip awoke very early and pulled on his gym clothes, planning on spending half an hour on the stair climber machine. But as he dressed, he opened his window and was surprised by the crisp breeze. Instead of going to the workout room, he pulled on a sweatshirt and took a long walk through Sydney and watched the city come to life. It was just after 4:30 a.m. as Philip hit the street, and there was no action yet to be seen. Then, step by step, the city woke up. First were the bakery trucks and newspaper deliveries, then deliveries of laundry, of groceries, and of half a dozen other goods. Then came the first cars full of people getting to their early jobs. By the time the sun came up, there was a low hum of activity. Then, within another hour, the city was fully engaged in the thousands of intertwined activities that kept the better part of 2 provinces moving and growing. What 2 days of complete rest were to Philip's body, this was to his soul. He walked for 2 hours, smiling at the men and women who were the very life of that city, and offering them his own silent worship. That afternoon, Philip stopped at the Sydney Skunk Works for the last time. They would be entirely out of the facility in only a few more days. Mordecai had sold the chemical company and most of the team was moving to Tokyo, where a new facility was being prepared. While most of them had already gone, a few were left, along with a variety of movers and construction workers. The entire facility was more a construction site than a laboratory now. Philip watched as the workers removed the sign saying, "We have no rules here. We're trying to accomplish something." The feeling was bittersweet, knowing on one hand that he would never see this place again, and on the other, that the sign and everything else were being moved to a new place that would be not only as good, but better. In fact, the Tokyo facility was now necessary. In Tokyo, they would have fast, easy access to any type of laboratory and testing facility. They didn't have that in Sydney. And shipping samples back and forth to laboratories was not only time-consuming, but clumsy. Tokyo had everything they wanted, and was large enough that they wouldn't stand out. And of course, they needed to leave Sydney. 2 years in one place is generally the maximum safe stay for things that are not approved by a government. And they were approaching that time. They had no problems, but they had clearly stayed long enough. These thoughts led Philip again to thinking about getting his family out of the US. He didn't want them there if things got ugly. He could not rule out the possibility that they'd go after his kids in order to hurt him. 2 of his children, Anna and Joel, were already living in Europe. But Rachel and Sarah remained in the US. It was Rachel's husband that Philip had talked to a few nights before. He seemed interested in getting a job transfer to either Australia or New Zealand. This was a bit far for Philip's liking, but they were nice places, and it would certainly remove them from the US. Sarah would be happy enough to leave, but she was waiting for a good job offer. As it later became apparent, Philip was far from the only parent concerned that his children might face a difficult life in the United States. Few people had expected this, but in retrospect, there was a certain logic to it. With all of the recent problems of terrorism, financial scandals, and flamboyant crimes, a host of authoritarian laws and regulations had been implemented. People were regularly being searched. There were increasing roadblocks, continual government inspections of bank records, ridiculous tax penalties, and surveillance agencies that were invading every area of life. In most nations, there is a common national group, but not in the US.
Almost every person there is the descendant of someone who ran away from some other place. Grandpa fled the old country and passed along the ideals that led him to it. As much as the rulers had tried long and hard to create an American mythos that would hold people to their territory, none of the ideas had taken hold sufficiently. At one time, there was the idea that the US was the terminus of the great East-to-West movement of progress. Progress, however, had long gone out of style. Then there was the idea that the US was the land of freedom. This was becoming hard to sell. There was, of course, the great image of the US as the winner of the Second World War, liberating Europe from Hitler. Obviously, there was some truth to this, but the story had been overplayed and people were losing interest in it. Given all of this, it might have been apparent that a considerable number of Americans would be ready to run away again, but no one really saw it coming, especially since it was a reverse situation. Traditionally, it had been the poor who would be most eager to leave. This time, it was the most productive. Again, it should have been obvious. In the old days, the poor were the oppressed. Now, it was the productive who were oppressed. Interestingly, many of them went back to the places their families had originally come from. At about the 6th month of Francis's second pregnancy, Anna Donson, Philip and Julia's oldest, came to visit, bringing her own daughters, Christine and Michelle. When Anna was a girl, she knew James Farber's Uncle Jim, so she knew Jim quite well, but had spent only a few hours with Francis at the time of the wedding, which was just after Anna and her family had moved to London. She and her husband Larry had met in college and had both worked in the physics department at Arizona State until Christine was born, now 6 years ago. Larry and Anna had been given the name the his and hers physicist some years earlier, and while the term was a bit insulting to Anna, the fact that she had married a man with such similar interests to her own suited her exceptionally well. In temperament, Anna was more Philip's child than she was Julia's. She had Philip's unconscious, powerful focus. Living with a man with different passions and direction than her own would have been a source of endless difficulties and compromises, much like those that her mother had pushed into for so long. Anna stopped working full-time before Christine was born, but still did about 10 hours per week of freelance work for the university. They moved to London when Larry was offered a teaching position at Imperial College. The money was good. There were future research projects promised, and they left London. The fact that her father was thrilled with the decision was not much of an issue to Anna. It was nice that he was happy, but that was not at all among their reasons for taking the position. All of the Dunson children were fiercely independent. Any control that either Philip or Julia had over them was long gone. The children would listen to their parents' opinions, but made up their own minds, and had for a long time. The visit began very pleasantly. Anna and Francis, who were less than 6 years apart in age, became instant friends, and Francis loved having two little girls in her house. Larry had been offered the chance to spend 6 weeks in Geneva working at the CERN accelerator, so it was a perfect time to go see Francis and Uncle Jim. By the time the first week was over, Anna and Francis were closer to each other than they were to any other people in the world, save their spouses and their immediate families. James was in and out, taking advantage of the visit to make a few business trips. Anna and her daughter slept in the house's large attic, which was finished well enough for comfortable living. Christine and Michelle each had their own beds and their own dressers. They thought the whole experience was great fun. Francis and Anna ended up taking turns getting up in the morning to take care of the children, who rose with the first light. There was no plan to do this. It was spontaneous. Francis saw that Anna was especially tired one morning and just jumped into action, closing the door to the attic so Anna wouldn't be interrupted, and not allowing the children to go upstairs until Anna was awake. Anna returned the favor the next day, and they simply continued the practice. The less tired mother getting up, and letting the more tired mom sleep in. Christine, Anna's 6-year-old, busied herself with taking care of the baby, especially feeding her and helping to change diapers. Michelle was only 3, so she was not able to do much, but she was excellent at helping baby Emily with her toys, especially when Emily was in her crib and the toys fell out. There was a near panic every time Francis's baby started to kick, with both Christine and Michelle desperate to feel it and trying to put Emily's hand on Francis's stomach to feel it as well. Minor disagreements were handled by the closest mother. It was simply more efficient that way, and made life more enjoyable for both women.
They spent their days teaching the older children, running out for English newspapers, discussing their lives and their husbands, teaching each other about science and economics, and occasionally hiring babysitters and taking an evening out. When James was in town, he seemed to slide into the existing situation and fill whatever slots the ladies left open for him. Frequently, he rose first in the morning and took care of breakfast for the children. When he did, the ladies tried to cook a dinner that he especially liked. Slowly, they began to realize that there was something about this lifestyle that they liked. Not that they would want to give up their private homes, but that they enjoyed living this way some of the time.
Francis, I think I just made some trouble for you.
Anna had taken her daughters to a local park. Emily had been taking a nap, and her girls were feeling energetic. So she bundled them up in warm clothes, it was late November, and let them play in the park while she sat on the bench, read the newspaper, and conversed with the local mothers. Now she was back at the house, talking of trouble.
What happened, Anna? Is everything all right?
Yeah, it's mostly all right, Francis, but I think I just made a few of your neighbors angry at you. Francis couldn't imagine what Anna could have done to anger people. Anna was always polite and kind.
What is it, Anna?
Anna looked down at the floor and seemed a bit guilty.
Well,
she said, then stopped. She froze for the fraction of a second, raised her head, and took on an expression of determination. She spoke firmly.
I have never lied to my children, Francis.
Francis nodded and waited for Anna to continue.
And I never told them the usual fairy tales, including Santa Claus.
Francis was starting to see the picture. Children in the park, Santa Claus, or at least a Dutch variation, Sinterklaas, who somehow sails in from Spain with gifts for the children on 5th December.
Anyway, Christine was playing in the park with the other children, several of whom spoke English rather well, and their conversations came around to their version of Santa and Christmas.
Oh, I understand, said Francis. Christine simply told them the truth, which would have seemed completely natural to her.
Right.
So, did the other children give her a hard time?
No, Francis, that is the problem. The other children were confused and ran to their mothers asking about it. It was the mothers who gave me a hard time.
Whoa, how bad was it?
Well, I was going to just pass it off, make some consolatory comments and leave, but Kristen was next to me and the other mothers wanted me to chastise her. I had no choice but to defend my daughter, which I did pretty convincingly, I think.
What did you say?
Oh, just what you would expect. That my daughter told the truth, that I was proud of her doing it, that I wasn't going to lie to my children just to make their lives successful.
Amidst her feelings of horror for the boorish behavior of her neighbors and her concerns for the future of the community, she couldn't help but laugh.
Yes, this is certainly the child of Philip and Julia, she thought to herself.
She hugged Anna.
Oh, don't worry about it, Anna. If I can't smooth it over with these people, I'll just move somewhere else.
Frances kept smiling, but in her mind she froze. She hadn't even thought about those words before they had come out of her mouth.
Move somewhere else?
Actually, it sounded like something James would say. It was certainly logical, but she hadn't even thought about moving away from Lycée. She more or less planned to stay here until the children were grown. She went back to her discussion with Anna, but made a mental note to come back to the subject and explore it in more details. The final week of Anna's visit was another week of joy, with Larry and James both there for the last several days. They did, however, try to avoid the neighbors, hoping to let the situation blow over.
Then you'll call me, Francis, as soon as the baby comes?
Absolutely, Anna. Just give me an hour or two to catch my breath. They both laughed. The four of them, Anna, Larry, Francis, and James, were standing in the carport on a cold, overcast morning, coffee or tea in hand, loading Anna and Larry's minivan with children and luggage. With luck, they could make it home that evening, and if not, the next morning. As the men finished talking and loading, Francis and Anna took a moment to themselves.
Francis, I really enjoyed this.
Yes, yeah, so did I, Anna. They both looked off into the distance for just a second or two, and quickly turned back to each other.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Said Francis.
Like of doing this again after the baby comes? Or traveling together?
Yes, shouted Francis, as they hugged each other and as the man turned around to see what was happening.
But I hadn't thought about traveling, Anna. It sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I think so. Listen,
Larry has a teaching opportunity in Prague in the spring. Do you think you'll be ready to travel at that point?
Frances did some quick calculations in her mind, giving birth in February and traveling perhaps 2 months later.
Yeah, and I think I could make it, maybe by mid-April.
And I love the idea of a Prague spring. You convince Larry to take the job, and I'll convince Jim to go.
Frances spent the remaining weeks of the pregnancy very quietly. Jim worked at home. Frances took care of Emily, made sure everything was ready for the new baby, and prepared herself for the intense effort of childbirth. At least this time, she knew what to expect. Baby Jessica Adler was born on February 27th, a week past the due date, but perfectly healthy. Frances's labor this time was shorter and less difficult. Her preparation had paid off. As with Emily, her local doctor was in attendance, as Jessica was born in Frances's own bedroom, with James assisting. As planned, Michael and his fiancée, Chloe, came to Lycée and stayed in a guest room during the birth for almost 2 weeks afterward. They were quickly succeeded by Frances's parents, then Jim's parents, each of whom stayed for about 10 days. 8 days after birth, Michael thought it safe to give Frances the new version of the Breakers treatment. He took small blood samples for several days before and for several days after. He also took small samples of Jessica's blood and some of the blood and cells from her umbilical cord. Michael shipped the samples back to the new lab in Tokyo. It would be a few weeks before any results were available, and perhaps a lot longer before they could be correctly interpreted. Nonetheless, Frances felt much better after this delivery than she had after the first.
Max, when are you going to get onto the internet?
Max Kaminsky gripped the telephone tightly and swiveled his chair so he would be facing away from the open office door and would not easily be overheard.
I don't need it, Anthony. I run my business without it, and I've never needed it before. Why should I bother?
Because, Max, that's the only way you're going to be able to communicate with young John Morales. He paused just for a moment. And I know you love that kid. Max didn't speak right away, and Barry waited.
Yeah, I'm fond of the kid, that's true.
And you really can't have phone conversations with him now, Max. You know that they record every international call. Only secure email is good enough. And sometimes I worry about that.
All right, Tony. Will you set me up?
I'll tell you what. I'm going to have my computer guy come over and get you going. Then I'll come over with some add-on stuff, okay?
Sounds fine, Anthony.
Thanks.
No problem, Max. You'll like being connected.
John Morales had been in Paris and had been asking Barry about Max. Johnny's father had died when he was still in college, and that void only intensified the natural affection that existed between him and Max. Max told him the truth, without any BS, which was unlike anyone else he had ever known. Sometimes it was difficult to hear, but Max tolerated no lies, large or small, ever. John Morales found that rare and valuable. Within a week, Barry had Max into Gamma, and communicating privately with John Morales. John was in Paris for the time being, but was seriously considering joining the skunk hackers in Japan. They were eager for him to come, and were busy telling him how much fun Tokyo could be. Morales mentioned something to Max about meeting him there, but Max was beginning to feel his age and wasn't interested in much travel. His wife's health was a bit fragile as well. He was minded to stay in LA, and possibly to sell the tavern. Perhaps a vacation to Japan, but no more than that. There had been a slow stream of news and opinions against private commerce even before the articles Frances wrote for the New York Times. But this time, they were considerably more frequent, and they were now becoming coordinated in their themes. Were the various organizations interested in tracking such things, they would have found that weekly talking points were being produced in an office in the basement of the US White House, then sent to news organizations around the world. And, had they been interested, they might have learned that the best of these items were leaked to a few favored reporters several days before they were distributed in general. The primary theme of the anti-private commerce stories was that terrorists might be using Gamma. There was little, if any, evidence of such a thing happening, and the news people always said, possibly, yet the impression was very clear. There was a correlation being made between private commerce and terrorism. This began to show up in the plots of television shows and of movies.
Talk radio and internet news people were divided on the anti-Gamma campaign. They disliked the government and media use of innuendo and half-truths. But many were unsure whether terrorists really did use the system. The establishment news outlets, on the other hand, spoke with nearly a single voice in their dislike for Gamma. And they all kept repeating the same emotion. Gamma is dangerous and undermines our way of life. For the most part, James and Francis didn't concern themselves with Gamma anymore. They had two beautiful children, and raising a family was now their focus. Besides, Gamma didn't need them. There were now millions of people involved. When problems sprung up, there were more than enough people to solve them. Nonetheless, they stayed in touch, and there was no avoiding the anti-Gamma campaign, which reached the Netherlands on a daily basis. It bothered James. He had seldom ever turned back from a battle, and it hurt him to stand aside without fighting back. Every so often, Francis would find Jim in his office, talking back to the television. "So we're the evil facilitators of terror, are we?" "Yeah, well, how many terrorists use your telephone system, asshole? Maybe all of them? And how many use the mail? So why don't you want to close them down? How about your banking system? All money laundering goes through that, so why not shut it down?" "No, you only want to shut down what you don't control, you lying pricks." This concerned Frances at first, but she learned to let Jim blow off his excess pressure. You can't ask a lifelong fighter to turn away from the fight completely. She gave him back rubs and reminded him of his annual piece in the Wall Street Journal. Jim had republished his original essay on its one-year anniversary, but hadn't taken time to write a second essay as he had originally planned. He was simply too busy with a new child. "Jim," she said as she walked into his office following one of his diatribes, "when are you going to write that second essay?" He turned, looked both surprised and curious. "Oh, I don't know. Why?" "Oh, just because it seems like a good idea to me. I know you don't want to jump back into the battle, but I think it might be good for you to speak your mind." His expression was as if he had just discovered something very pleasant. "You know, I think that's a great idea. Thank you." "You're very welcome," she said, walking out and feeling very happy with herself.
Juan, come here."
There were two men in dark suits at Martha Castro's front door. She didn't know who they were, but it was obvious that they represented some government agency. Juan understood from the sound of her voice that there was trouble. He picked up his old marine knife, reversed his grip to tuck it behind his forearm, and proceeded to the front door, which he chained and opened several inches. "What do you want?" Juan was a mixture of angry and frightened. Martha was now moving away from the door into the living room.
"Only to make a delivery, Mr. Castro. We only want to deliver something to Mrs. Castro and to get her assurance that she will deliver it to Mr. Farber."
"We would have delivered it to Mr. Farber's office. It has been closed lately. We know that Mrs. Castro still works for him. So we came here. We are sorry for the intrusion."
"You weren't very sorry for the intrusion when you threw my wife out of her office in January and into the cold."
"That was a very unfortunate event, Mr. Castro, and the officers involved have been disciplined. We are sorry. It will not happen again." Juan was partially pacified and less scared. At least they apologized. He glanced at Martha to make sure he had heard the apology. She ever so slightly nodded her head. It would have been almost imperceptible to anyone else, but Juan understood her acknowledgement.
"So what is it you want Martha to deliver for you?"
"Just this letter, Mr. Castro."
"And then you don't come here anymore?"
"It will be fine, Mr. Castro. After this, we will not bother you again."
"Good. And Martha only works for Mr. Farber for 3 more months, you understand? Then she retires."
"Yes, sir, we understand. May Mrs. Castro talk to us for a moment, sir?"
Martha was walking up at the same time and extended her hand to take the letter.
"What is it you want me to do?"
"Only to get this to Mr. Farber, ma'am."
"I don't see Mr. Farber anymore."
"Yes, ma'am. But if you could just tell him that you have it."
Martha thought for a few seconds, which to her seemed a minute.
"I will give it to his attorney."
The men looked at each other.
"Oh, that will be fine, ma'am. Good night."
And with that, they walked away. Martha opened the envelope and looked at the document.
"What is it, Martha?"
Well, it looks like an invitation for Mr. Farber to do something in Germany.
Juan and Marta looked at each other, wondering what it meant.
I'll go send it now to Mr. Farber, Juan.
Marta turned on the computer that Farber had sent to her, logged on, and sent an encrypted email to Farber's secure address.
Hello, Mr. Farber. I just had two more government men, this time at my door. But no problem this time. Juan answered the door for me, and there was no problem. They did give me a letter for you. It is short, so I will just type the contents for you here.
To James Farber.
Mr. Farber, please accept this invitation to the annual meeting of the Bilderberg Group. We will be meeting this year at the Maritime Hotel Complex in Bonn, Germany, from 21st through 24th of August. Your name will be placed on the list for admittance, and a room will be reserved for you. You are welcome to bring one companion. Many of our members are very anxious to discuss private commerce and its implication for the future. In the event that you may be worried about your personal security, please be assured that you have my personal guarantee of safe, unobstructed passage to and from our meetings. You will not be interfered with. Sincerely, Peter A. van Vlack, Central Director General, Federal Republic of Germany.
That is all there is, Mr. Farber. I hope it's good news. I told the agents that I would give it to Mr. Miller, but when I opened it, I found it was easier just to send it to you. I will give it to Mr. Miller tomorrow while I visit him about our lawsuit against the FBI for throwing me out in the cold. If we get the settlement Mr. Miller expects, Juan and I will travel around the world and maybe find a warm place to retire. Thank you, Marta.
Marta, thank you for sending me the note. I'm not sure if it's good news or not. I'm not going to these meetings, although I might send a friend in my place. We'll see. Don't tell anyone, but when you take your trip, Miller assures me that you'll have a nice settlement very soon. Let me know your schedule through Europe. We'll have to be kind of secretive about it, but I'll bring you and Juan to our house here, and you can see my daughters. I hope it will be soon. James Farber.
Philip, this is James.
Philip was on his way to London to visit Anna and her family, then on to Lyon to see his son, Joel. He was looking forward to a couple of weeks of playing dad and grandpa and visiting some friends.
Hey, Jim, how are Francis and the new baby?
Oh, they're great. But listen, I have something for you here.
Oh yeah? What's that?
Jim laughed before he spoke.
Ha! Well, believe it or not, we have an invitation signed by the Central Director General of Germany, inviting me to the annual meeting of the Bilderberg Group. Can you believe that? Oh, come on. You're not serious, are you?
Completely. They want to talk about private commerce.
Whoa. So, are you going to go?
Nah, I've got two babies and I've retired from that stuff. At least until my kids are grown. I thought you might want to go.
Well, I'm not so sure. I've been trying to retire too.
Yeah, I know. But this is a ticket to the inner sanctum, Philip. That's your speciality, not mine.
I don't know, Jim.
Okay, that's fine by me. But it might be very helpful to talk to some of these people. If nothing else, it would help to locate our enemies.
Well, that is true. But they might just be trying to get their hands on one of us.
Yeah, that's possible. And they're certainly aware of that concern. This director, and he is a major figure, gives me his personal guarantee of safety in the invitation. Not that I would put too much faith in that. I'll tell you what, I'll write back to them, telling them that I can't come, but that I have someone who could represent me. We'll see what they say. And you can think about it in the meantime. Sound good?
Sounds very good, Jim.
Well, well, this will be interesting. The big annual gathering of the establishment. Presidents, key legislators, top media people, financial titans, the whole lot of them. Like I said, crossing intellectual swords with those people would suit you far better than it would me. Why don't you talk it over with McCoy and see if he thinks it could be safe?
Yeah, I will.
Then Philip stopped. Julia had told him for years that he was going to work himself to death, that he'd never be able to turn down the next cool project, and that he'd kill himself through overwork, just like a lot of his heroes had done.
But Jim?
Asked Philip.
When I get done with this one, I'm getting out. All the way out. No more projects, no more fights. I'm quitting indefinitely.
I don't blame you, Philip. So what are you going to do when you quit?
I think I'm going to alternate between playing grandpa, traveling, and laying around on beaches. The truth is, if I don't get away from the tumult for a while, I probably won't live long. Okay then, I'll expect you to vanish from public view in September. Might I suggest that you publish a few more essays between now and then? I'd like you to cover all of the essential subjects. Philip smiled. Oh, you bet, Jim, I'll do that.
Great, Philip. And I'll let you know when I hear back from the director. I'll send you a copy of the invitation, too.
Bye. It was a year of war for the minds of common men. Knowledge of the Gamma markets was everywhere, and every right-thinking figure stood in opposition to them. Every leader of any organization that received government money was issuing statements to their people that unregulated commerce would destroy them. Patriotic appeals were made in dozens of countries, all drawing upon allegiance to the land of our fathers, our ancestral home, or a dozen other slogans. Appeals were made to elderly people to talk to their grandchildren, that if the Gamma markets kept up, their pensions and government checks would stop. Minority groups blamed Gamma for any reduction in government spending, calling Gamma racist because it hurt minorities worse than it did other people. At first, the politicians didn't want to address Gamma directly, fearing that it would simply draw more people to it. But now they were passing fugitive money laws and were attempting to track down all money that was made on their land, then moved elsewhere before it was taxed. They began to criticize the internet as uncivilized and dangerous. Businesses were required to submit monthly reports of all payments they made to any outside contractor or service. Huge fines were levied for non-compliance. Rewards were placed for the recovery of untaxed money, and anyone whose information led to a recovery was to be paid 1/3 of the amount recovered. The talk radio hosts were still divided, and some radio stations were pressured into removing broadcasters that defended Gamma. The most popular internet sites, which had previously been divided half for Gamma and half against, were now 3/4 in favor of private commerce. The attacks on the internet had convinced them that the governments no longer deserved the benefit of the doubt. Graffiti began appearing in London and New York, usually in gold and white, saying "opt out" or "Gamma." Similar graffiti was found in other cities shortly thereafter. The markets themselves continued to grow. Huge numbers of people in Asia were joining. In fact, it had become a popular symbol of individuality to do business in one of these Japanese Gamma markets. People in Cuba, North Korea, Burma, and the other remaining dictatorships were logging into any possible Gamma markets as soon as an internet connection would be found. Almost every educated person in such a situation was looking to Gamma as a place to sell their services for a fair price. A great number of people played good establishment boy during the day, while secretly a player in Gamma by night, or when no one was watching them at work. Rumors of stunning new inventions began to circulate. New drugs were available, new genetic treatments, even cloned organs were available, but only in the private digital economy. The regulated economy had most of these treatments tied up in approvals for 7 to 10 years or more. And that after you found and paid the right people to get your product approved. In the private digital economy, the customer did his own safety checks, but you could have the treatment you want, when you want. Beside this, a trade war was breaking out. The Europeans were blaming American companies for exporting anti-social ideas and placing tariffs on US goods. The US, in return, raised their already high tariffs on European products. Then they both raised tariffs on Asian goods, which they couldn't allow to enter their economies at a relative discount. Large companies and political contributors were calling their politicians daily, making sure that their business would either be protected or avenged. It was getting out of hand, and the usual G8 manipulation of the stock and precious metals markets was beginning to fail. Scapegoats would have to be made, and quickly. James Farber was awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning, with Frances twisting and sweating, obviously in a nightmare. As he debated whether to wake her, the dream began to subside, and she opened her eyes. "Frances, are you all right?"
Oh, Jim, oh, that was a very unpleasant dream.
Yeah, I could tell. What was it?
She gestured for him to wait a few seconds, then rolled over to a more comfortable position.
Well, in the dream, I was going about my daily chores and passed by a mirror on our wall. Something about the mirror caught my attention, and I stopped to take a good look. She paused, looking uncomfortable. And when I looked at it, I could see everything else in the house, but couldn't see myself.
Oh, that's kind of spooky.
Yeah, it was. But that wasn't all.
Go on, Jim said, wondering what was happening within Francis to cause such a dream. He wondered if it had anything to do with the Breakers treatment after Jessica was born.
Well, I should back up and say that I had almost the same dream a few days ago. A few details were different, but it was essentially the same.
Now Jim was fairly sure that there was some substance to this dream, not just a too full belly.
Anyway, I looked again, and I still couldn't see myself. So I went up to our little bathroom upstairs, closed the door, and went to my own mirror. I could see myself this time, which made me feel better. But as I stared at myself, I noticed that there was something way up above my upper teeth, almost up behind my eyes. I pulled my upper lip back as far as I could and saw that there was some sort of implant there. It also seemed like I had known all about it when it was put in, but somehow I had forgotten. Am I making sense?
Well, yes you are, Francis, but it sounds pretty nasty.
Oh yeah?
She laughed just a little.
Well, this implant had some sort of wires attached to it that went into my head. How's that?
Oh, that's worse.
Yeah. Anyway, this is where the dream stopped the first time. But this time I made myself stay there and inspect the implant. And then I forced myself to grab it and pull it out of my head. Then I searched the other side of my mouth, found another one, and pulled that one out too. The funny thing is, once I pulled them out, they didn't look so scary.
She began to smile now. Jim wondered why, but waited rather than asked.
Then, Jim, I threw the implants away and walked back downstairs to the mirror.
And this time you could see yourself?
And this time I could see myself, bright and shining.
3 weeks later, it began to happen again. Francis seemed to be having a bad dream, waking Jim up. But this time, the dream seemed to lead nowhere. They were dark, unpleasant dreams of Francis having something stolen from her and her life being made exceptionally difficult with no recourse available. There were no family deaths and no ghouls jumping out at her, so the dreams didn't have a horrifying nightmare aspect. But they were very unpleasant and started her days on a very bad note. Privately, Jim sent a note to Philip, who seemed to know how to interpret dreams. Philip replied as follows.
Honestly, Jim, I think Francis is struggling to make a big step forward. These things are quite murky, so I'm not certain. But to me, this sounds like it is going to resolve itself well. Think of it as her fighting her way through a nasty underbrush to get some prize. I just hope it's over soon. For almost 2 weeks, these dreams continued, almost every night, until the dream resolved into one consistent set of impressions. Francis was always being robbed, though she could never quite tell how, why, or by whom. In the dreams, she was always in a place that was dark and misty, so she could barely ascertain her surroundings. The main point of the dream seemed to be that she was endlessly frustrated and felt very dark.
It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, just before sunrise. Francis sat up in bed, breathing hard and wet with sweat. Jim sensed something wrong and sat up simultaneously.
Again?
She nodded.
Yes, but I got to the end this time, Jim. Although I'm not sure I understand it.
Okay, breathe a little bit first. Are you all right?
Yes, I'm just a bit overwrought.
Okay, can you tell me about it? She turned and sat on the edge of the bed, with her feet on the floor. Jim slid himself next to her and waited for her to speak.
Okay, she said, taking a few seconds to steady herself. Here's what happened. I was in the same dark place, feeling very dark. Again, my things were taken away, and I didn't know why. Actually, it seemed that I was being very perceptive, even to know that there was theft involved. To sense anything distinct,
beside just the darkness. She was speaking slowly and carefully. Jim wanted to comfort her, but not to intrude, so he sat close to her and waited. I began to see a little bit better, and I could see a car in front of me, and somehow I knew it was mine. And there was a man taking things out of it, stealing my things. I stood there for a while, not knowing what to do. The man didn't seem to notice me at all, but I knew that those were my things he was taking. I had to do something, but I tried, and I couldn't speak. I wanted to yell at him. Nothing came out of my mouth, almost as if those muscles were paralyzed. She stopped. Again, Jim considered putting his arm around her and hugging her, but he just didn't think that was right. Then, she turned to Jim, I looked down and gathered whatever strength I could find in myself. Then I looked back up at the man taking my stuff and said, no. My strength was so small that the words were quieter than I'm using right now, almost a whisper, although I was trying to yell as loudly as I could. But the man heard me. He turned to see who had spoken. I was scared, wondering if he'd attack me. As weak as I felt, I don't think I could have put up much of a fight. But he ran off, which scared me again, because it looked like he ran almost right for me. But as he approached, he just disappeared, like he ran out of the frame of a movie. She stopped now, seemingly to catch her strength again. Is that all, babe? No, there's more, James. Hang on. No, he did put his arm around her. Take your time, doll. It's okay now. They sat together for another half minute or so. Then she straightened herself to finish. Okay, after the man had run off, I just stood there, wondering. I could see the car in front of me, and I was relieved that it was no longer being stolen from. But everything was still so dark and confused. And then... She took a deep breath and tried to keep her focus so she could explain it correctly. And then something in front of me began to move, and I saw a workman carrying off a huge piece of dark plate glass that had been in front of me the whole time. I looked more carefully, and there was a man on each end of a huge piece of darkened glass. It had been in front of me the whole time, and I hadn't known it. I thought I was facing the man who was stealing from me, but I wasn't. That's why he seemed to run off into nowhere. He and the car had actually been behind me. And that's all? Yes, that's it. After that, I woke up. Wow. As the sun began to stream into the house, Emily, as was her habit, began to call out for either mommy or daddy, wanting to get her out of her crib and begin exploring for another day. The child was amazingly inquisitive. She wanted to see everything, to feel it, to taste it, to know it. James stepped in front of Frances to go to Emily and suggested to Frances that she should take a shower and regroup. She thanked him and did so. This would give her a bit more time before Jessica would arise, hungry as always and desperate to nurse. Jim changed Emily, then fed her. By the time Frances was finished in her shower, Jessica was up and crying for her. Frances wrapped herself in a large towel, carried Jessica into her bedroom, and fed her there. When they were done, she carried Jessica back to the nursery and changed her. From the window, she saw that James had put Emily into some warm clothes, taking her out to the backyard, and was alternating between watching Emily and reading his Wall Street Journal while drinking a large cup of coffee. But James was not reading the paper as closely as it appeared. He kept thinking about the dream. He had a deep feeling that there was something important about it, and that he didn't understand it. Emily started to reach for a clay flower pot. It was on top of an old outdoor table, which caught his attention. He was about to call to Emily and tell her to stop, that she could get hurt. But somehow he felt wrong this time. He didn't know why, but Jim had learned years ago to first pay attention to such instincts and to figure them out later. He got up and walked over to the child. Emily, look at me, she did. Emily, remember the man you saw with the hurt on his arm? Emily had noticed a prominent scar on the arm of a neighbor a few days before, and it had taken them a while to explain to her that bad hurts don't always go away. He waited until it looked like she understood sufficiently. Emily, you don't let your arm get a big hurt. You see this pot?
Kids,
she said in her small 2-year-old voice. Here, feel how heavy it is. He brought the pot down to the ground and tipped it so she could place her hand against it and feel its weight. He showed her twice to make sure she grasped the concept. "Now, Emily, if you pull on this bottom part here, this top part could fall and give you a big hurt. Protect your arm from that, Emily. You like your arm, right?" He was speaking slowly, trying to use only words that he knew that she understood, which wasn't easy. She nodded that she did understand. "Then, if you like your arm, keep it away from hurts, okay?" She looked at him with recognition, agreeing that keeping her arm safe was a good thing. Then he picked her up and explained to her how large, heavy things could fall. He repeated the lesson to make sure she understood and placed her back on the ground, going back to his coffee and newspaper. "So, getting a bit of that nice frigid air?" Francis was smiling, carrying a thoroughly bundled baby Jessica in a baby chair and her own cup of coffee. She sat down and picked up one section of the paper. "Yeah," said Jim. "I thought that since it wasn't too cold, I'd take advantage of it and let Emily get some air too. I see our baby woke up as well, huh?" He was playing with Jessica and appreciating the miracle of reproduction. "Just amazing," was all he said. After a moment, he sat back in his chair and picked up the paper. But again, he didn't read much. He was sure Francis would soon be trying to find the meaning of her dream, and he was sure that the answer would have to come from her, not from him. He wondered if he could do anything to help her find it. "Jim, do you think that dreams have any relevance or meaning?" "Oh, yeah, I do." "Then tell me why." "Well, because it was roiling around inside of you for a long time and seemed to push very hard to make its way to your consciousness. I think there had to be a good reason for that." "Huh. Well, I think I agree. That leaves us with the question of what it means. Any ideas?" He tried to think of something that would be helpful, but didn't come up with anything. "No, nothing but the obvious. That you were feeling very dark because your goods were being taken, and you couldn't stop it. And that you eventually gathered strength enough to say no, and that the theft then stopped. I'm afraid I don't know what to think of that plate glass." She looked down, deep in thought. Jim kept an eye on the children to compensate. "I think there's something very important about that last part, Jim, but I don't know what." She seemed stuck, unable to move forward. "All right, sit up." He took a commanding tone in his voice, something he never did when speaking to Francis. She sat up. "Work with me, Francis." He was speaking fast now, as if directing players in a sporting event or in a military exercise. "We begin with your goods being stolen and you feeling very bad as the result, yes?"
"Yes,"
she said, matching his tone and intensity. "But the theft was not necessarily literal theft. It was more symbolic, the loss of important things that were mine."
"Good. And the car?"
"Irrelevant, just a tool to help the dream make sense." She wasn't sure how she knew that, but it dawned on her just before she opened her mouth.
"Now, what about the difficulty of saying no?"
"I'm not altogether sure, but it seemed that the ability to say no was something I should probably have had, but the ability had atrophied long ago and was barely functional."
"Anything else on saying no?"
"Nothing."
"Fine, then what about the glass? It was dark, correct?"
"Correct."
"And you didn't notice it before the end?"
"Not at all."
"Then why is the glass significant? What does it mean?"
"I don't know, Jim."
She was beginning to get tired of his demands and shot him a look that expressed her irritation. But instead of reacting as she expected, he raised his voice to just below the level that would cause concern to their neighbors and increased his intensity.
"But what if you did know, Francis? What would that answer be?"
She looked at him blankly, bristling at the illogic of his statement. Now his eyes were very demanding, as well as his voice.
"You hurt me. What if you did know the answer? What would it be? Tell me now."
In surprise and anger, she yelled back at him.
"How the hell should I know? It took my whole field of view."
Something was coming together in her mind. Jim had seen this look on her face before, but never this pronounced.
"And it was dark, and it misdirected my vision away from the thief."
"And?"
"And that's how it is with people. They're always looking at the negatives, at the dark, at the ugly. That's what they see and no more. They sense the thefts, but they can't find them, can't really react to them. They're always looking in the wrong place."
She understood, but she wasn't sure he did.
She got up from her chair and paced around the yard, ignoring him, ignoring the children, and talking quietly but intensely to herself. After several minutes, she turned and said,
"Why did you do that to me? Push me like that?"
"Because I thought it was necessary." She looked slightly hurt. So he stood, walked to her, hugged her, and said, "Don't worry. I have no plans to do it again, and I wouldn't have risked it if I didn't think that in retrospect you would have wanted me to." The fact that he was thinking of what she would have wanted made her feel better. It was later that afternoon when she walked into his office where he was working.
"What if I did know?"
He looked up and smiled.
"I say I have no idea, and you demand to know what I think the answer would be if I did know. What kind of stupid wordplay is that?"
He laughed loudly, pushed his chair back from the desk, and motioned to her to come to him. He sat her in his lap, looked up softly at her, and said, "Well, it worked, didn't it?" Now she laughed.
"Yeah, I guess it did. But where on earth did you come up with that one?"
He smiled and gave her a mischievous glance.
"Philip,"
she said.
"Yep,"
he laughed, as Emily waddled into the room. Francis picked her up.
"You want to illuminate a bit?"
He was still laughing slightly.
"Sure. That's one of Philip's secret tricks when he needed to figure something out. He says he changes his consciousness, however that is done, and demands answers of himself. He says he got the idea from a scripture that says, 'You know all things.' And he decided to act as though that verse was actually true and demanded answers of himself." Francis tilted and shook her head.
"This is no normal guy, is he?"
The next morning, and with the dream not returning, Francis decided to ask Philip about the subject of a negative focus. At first, she was going to call, but then she decided to write instead. That way, she would have a permanent record of everything in her notes. Beside, she wasn't sure where Philip was. She wrote 2.5 pages and sent them. Meanwhile, John Morales was settling into the strangeness of Tokyo and to the adventure of new friends. His exit from the United States had been uneventful, and he had thoroughly enjoyed his 4-week stay in Paris. He had never been there before, and it was better than he had expected. The people he met at the Skunk Works were overwhelmingly English-speaking, and he was spending enough time with them that the strangeness of Tokyo didn't seem to press in on him. In fact, Tokyo seemed more like a place he was just passing through, and he found it surprisingly liberating to be in a place that he didn't feel beholden to. His work began as he had expected. He fit in very well with the other computer jocks, trading tips on breaking passports, notes on how various systems worked, who had broken into what previously, and so on. They even surprised him by showing him the back doors for at least a dozen government systems, US, EU, and UN. It turned out that they got considerable help from the older programmers who built the systems originally. Always an anti-authoritarian and free-minded breed, these people sent over their secrets when they saw Gamma attacked. This explained how the hunters were so successful. John had guessed that they were highly skilled, which they were, but he couldn't imagine that they could be that good. Having the secret backdoors explained a lot. But as well as Morales got along with the hunters, he seemed to be drawn elsewhere, to the researchers. Several times per day he found himself walking over to one group or another and inquiring about their work. What were they trying to prove? How was the experiment constructed? How were variables eliminated? In all his life, he had never even imagined himself doing scientific research. It was not something he ever saw or had even considered within his realm of possibilities. Yet when he actually confronted it, he was irresistibly drawn to it. After 2 weeks of non-stop questions, a group of researchers offered Morales a half-time job managing a medical experiment. He enjoyed it immensely and stole away whatever free time he could to read biochemistry texts.
"Hi, Francis. Sorry it took so long to get back with you. I've been traveling with a few of my grandkids. I'm so pleased you're breaking new ground in this. It's one of the subjects I came across years ago and wanted to really focus on, but didn't get to. Okay, here are some thoughts. I first came across this idea in the work of one of the 20th century's great Christian thinkers, a man named Kenyon. He wrote about sin conscious versus righteousness conscious. He said that the work of Christ was to remove us from a consciousness focused on our sins, deficits, to a consciousness focused on our righteousness, assets. Did you know that there is even a scripture that says,
You are the righteousness of God? What would someone who truly thought of himself that way be like? A lot better than most people, I think. What would it be like to have no sense of built-in fault or weakness, but rather to see and appreciate our own innate goodness, our abilities, and our beautiful possibilities? Anyway, Kenyon is obviously coming at this from a purely religious perspective, but he is right. The central picture of the austere, judging God, of the judging ruler, same thing writ small, of the chastising parent, smaller still, all of these teach people to look at deficits and to interpret everything as if it were or could be a negative thing, to examine every natural thing for an aspect that could cause pain, embarrassment, or loss. Then, all of the anti-self ideas that humanity swims in fill any leftover gaps and seal the mind. It is all a mistake. It is all harmful. It must all be eliminated if we hope to have healthy souls. And if you try, you can recast every thou shall not as an opportunity to do good. Beside all of this, the negative focus is simply a logical error. Proper thinking is to examine positive and negative aspects on equal weightings, at equal volumes, if you will. To radically overweigh the negatives and to pass over the positives, as is endemic in humanity now, is simply an error. It cannot help but wither the soul and leads to endless pain and disaster. What you have come upon, Francis, is a monumental issue. Congratulations, Philip. James had been out this day, running a few errands in Amsterdam and conducting one meeting. He got home just before dinner and happened to notice Francis's letter from Philip, which he had printed and had apparently been reviewing. He thought he would ask her about it during dinner, but feeding and cleaning the children kept him from it. After dinner, however, he convinced Francis to get a neighbor girl to watch the children for them and to take a walk together. The night was cold, but she agreed. As they made a circuit around Lycée, their conversation made its way from the children to the dream and Philip's comments. Francis explained her letter to Philip and his response. And do you really think it's as big a deal as Philip says, Francis? Well, I'm not absolutely certain, but it seems very important. From childhood on, it is the negative things that we hear at high volumes. When you do something well, you may get a few kind words, but when you do something bad, you get yelling. When you pass tests, that is expected, but when you fail, you get dire consequences. All of this focuses us on negativity. Don't you agree, James? Yes, I suppose I do. And do you remember Philip's fairy tale explanation? If you mean that first time we went to dinner, yeah, I think so. Well, those fairy tales leave you focusing on how you fail to meet the standard of the perfect prince or the perfect princess. Our deficits become central to our minds, and everything else, all of our values, doesn't show up. All we see are our deficits. All laws and commandments are negative-centric. Any of them could easily be recast positively, but no one thinks that way. It would seem silly. Humanity has been trained to pay attention to negative things and negative possibilities and to ignore their own positives. Then what's the other side of this, Francis? What should be done? Okay, Jim, look at it this way. What if we gave ourselves credit for our own goodness and abilities? What if we considered how wonderful we were? If we reveled in our abilities? If we gloried in the great things we are able to do, rather than worrying about the things we're not able to do? What if we thought of ourselves as righteous beings walking the planet, rather than as dark beings always on the verge of error? Well, that would be a huge difference. That's right, and a positive one. Philip is right. Try this, say it out loud. I am righteousness walking the earth in human form. Go ahead. He felt strange saying such a thing, but he did it anyway. Now, Jim, how do you feel when you say that? Different, to be sure. He didn't put the pieces together till a few minutes later, but what it actually reminded him of was saying, I did see that man hurt his wife when he was a boy, one of the key events of his life.
Did it feel like something inside you is being reactivated?
Yeah, maybe so.
Jim, this is big. I don't even know how people who have their focus restored to neutral, let alone positive, will think of themselves. But that is the way I want my children to grow up.
Her gaze grew distant again, and she slowed down.
Jim, this means that we're going to have to work hard to keep them from being focused on negatives. The whole world is against it.
She realized just how important this was to her.
Do you agree, Jim?
Well, let me think about this for a few minutes, will you, Francis?
Sure, she said,
and they walked on for another kilometer in silence. She felt like she could barely think or breathe, waiting a seemingly endless time for an answer. So still was her mind that she didn't even worry about what he would say, or perhaps any responses.
You know what, Francis? I think you're right.
She grabbed his arm and leaned on him in relief.
Now I'm with you 100% in principle on this, but I'm not certain what our best actions should be. Although I'm sure you're right that we're going to be a lot different than other people and teach our kids differently.
This made Francis very happy.
And speaking of that, Francis, I'm getting a bit uncomfortable living here.
We remembered her conversation with Anna and that she didn't have time to re-examine it.
You mean the Santa controversy, Jim?
Yes, that and a few comments that have been made to me since.
What sort of comments?
She asked as they walked along the large puddle in the old road they were following.
Oh, a few things about not respecting traditions.
I haven't heard anything.
No, the people here are polite. They wouldn't say anything to a mother of two young girls. But they have made a few cryptic remarks to me. So if we are now going to be even more different, I think that we can't stay here for too long.
He wondered why people always said that moving around was bad, but didn't take time to explore the question.
Does that make you uncomfortable?
No, not really. It makes sense.
Then she stopped and smiled.
What?
Jim, how would you like to spend a few months in Prague?
Philip and Steve Caputa found themselves corresponding, not often, but at length. Steve asked important questions, which required lengthy answers. Philip enjoyed this far more than he thought he would. It had been a long time since he had worked with the Bible, and he found it interesting to go back to it a little bit. It had been long enough that he could read it now, without religious ideas intruding too powerful into his mind. Steve seemed interested in learning how to explain Philip's ideas to other people.
And to allow himself to believe them as well, Philip thought.
But Philip also wondered if there was more to it than that. After answering one of Steve's difficult questions, Philip asked him to meet in one of the Gamma chat rooms to talk further.
Hey, Philip. Something's on your mind?
Aye, Steve. Yeah, there is. I'm going to retire from all this stuff.
Wow. But how do you retire from thinking?
Oh, I don't mean that I'll stop figuring things out. Just that I won't be working on it. All the stuff we've talked about didn't just come to me. I studied long and hard. Very long and very hard. But from now on, I'm not going to. I'll still read things that interest me, and I'm sure I'll come up with new ideas, but I'm not going to work at it like I did. And I'm not going to try to get my ideas out to the world.
Are you tired?
No, not tired. More like worn. I pushed against huge obstacles for a lot of years. Decades, really. I've spent everything I can and then some. If I don't stop now, I'll end up sick or dead before long. There's only so long you can abuse yourself before you have to pay. Usually you get about 20 years. I'm well beyond that. I'm getting out before it's too late.
I understand. Does this have anything to do with the private markets?
No, nothing except that the markets were tiring work. Besides, they don't need me anymore.
Yeah, they seem to be doing just fine, in spite of all the hatred.
Yeah, I'm pleased. But listen, Steve, I want to ask you a couple of questions.
Shoot.
Okay, first, if I get any new ideas, can I send them to you for appropriate distribution?
I guess so.
Is there anything in particular I should do with them?
Nothing particular.
Only to get them out in the best ways that you know.
I guess I can do that. I hope I do it in a way that you like.
Ah, don't worry about that, Steve. Any benefit that comes from here on out is a bonus.
Okay, I'll do it.
Great. I'll just send you emails if I run across anything interesting. But I do have one other thing I'd like to think about. Have you ever thought about writing?
Philip, I can't do your job.
I'm not asking you to do my job, just to do your job. That is, if you think it might be something you'd like to do.
Well, I have thought about it, but I'm not sure I'd be good at it.
I understand, but I wish you'd think about it a bit more. It just takes a lot of effort.
I will. But let me ask you this. What are you hoping I'll write about?
Oh, I guess the things we talked about in Vancouver, for starters.
Damn, you're good.
And by that you mean?
That I've already been thinking about writing that up, more or less as an interview.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
Interesting. I'll pursue that.
Almost thou persuadest me to be a writer. I would that both, almost and altogether. Except for my scars.
I understand. Any other ideas or advice if I decide to be altogether?
Just to be honest and truthful as you know how to be. Oh, and do not ever let them turn you into a leader. Let them think and live for themselves. If you can be a bit of a specialist in some areas and throw some good information in the mix, that's great. And that's where you should stop. There are people who desperately want a leader. Rather than thinking and living for themselves, they want someone else to do it for them. Don't try to save them, and don't spell out every little detail for them. Let them do it themselves. And you see that I'm leaving, right? I did my part to help a few individuals wake up, and I'm glad I did. But I'm not their comforter, and I'm not their source. If they don't want to get off their asses and live under their own power, screw them. There are plenty of copies of the essays in existence. If 30 years from now they've all vanished, I'll republish. That's all. There will be people who just want to keep sucking in and want things to get difficult. These are the ones who will turn on you. Okay, I've ranted a bit. Anything else?
Only that I want to stay in touch.
No problem, Steve. Right anytime. Just don't ask me to do much.
It's a deal, Chief. I'll talk to you soon.
Enjoy your retirement. Thanks, Steve. I'll let you know if I come to the Northwest. Bye.
Philip, you need to be here. Something important is happening.
It was late April, and Europe was blossoming after a long winter. James and Francis had arrived a week earlier and had been surprised at the number of people who had shown up at the same time. They had told a number of their friends and relatives where they would be, and many of them came. In fact, Francis had specifically told several friends to bring any nice person you know. Apparently they had, and as it turned out, Anna had said virtually the same thing to many of her friends. By the end of the first week, it was clear that something unusual was happening. 20 or 30 people were there, and were sending notes to all of their friends, telling them what fun they were having. It seemed like people were simply springing up in some sort of spontaneous generation. Jim flew to Amsterdam for 3 days, and when he came back, most of the faces were new. Philip paused for a moment, moved his desk phone to the side, and put his feet up on his desk.
Okay, Jim, tell me what's happening. You're in Prague with Anna and her family, right?
Yeah, with Anna, Larry, and a couple of hundred other people.
A couple of hundred?
Yeah, and growing daily.
Whoa. And what are you all doing there?
Well, that's a good question, Philip. The idea was to come and live here for a few months, hanging out together, helping each other, finding a few adventures, and so on. Well, we told a bunch of friends to come. So did Anna. And then those people told their friends, and it kept going.
Philip was smiling broadly. He had seen this before.
Kind of spontaneous, Jim?
Yeah, completely.
And a very high caliber of people?
Yeah, very high.
And a lot of corporation, trading, and brainstorming?
Yeah. What do you know about this?
Philip laughed.
Just that those are the types of situation that I live for. Listen, I'm in France with Joelle, but I can get out of here in a day or two. Get me a nice room.
Count on it. Excellent. Oh, and one more thing, Jim.
What's that?
Get some of the boys together and tell them to buy or lease a few apartment houses and get ready for more people. This is too good to stay small. There are probably 10 other guys calling friends right now, just like you're calling me.
Will do. Bye.
The people kept coming. The quality of the event itself was certainly the core reason for this, but there were contributing factors. An exodus from the US was continuing. With their nation turning slowly into a police state, the most thoughtful people began to find ways to escape, many with plans to return once their nation stepped back from the precipice. The gathering in Prague was the natural place for these people to go, to reorient themselves and to find other people in their situations. Beside all this, Gamma people were now being blamed for nearly all imaginable ill, economic, military, or social. Thus far, most people considered such accusations to be simply rhetoric, but they knew the example of National Socialism too well. They did not want to play the role of the Jews. Once rhetoric became conventional wisdom, many decided that it was time to move on. But in Prague, every day was an adventure. People would wake up in the morning, take care of whatever business they had, then walk down to one of the local coffees to see who was there and what new things were happening. Once you hit one or two of these cafes, you never knew where the day would go, or the next week or month for that matter. There were so many people, so many projects, so many opportunities. And every few days, the crowd had greatly changed. One group would coalesce, combine their talents, refine a new venture, and not be seen in the cafes for days on end, being busy in their apartments, laboratories, or manufacturing shops. Occasionally, they would take a morning or an afternoon off and say hello to the cafe crowds, but they were immersed in their projects and didn't want to surface until the project was ready. There was a stream of new faces, a few old, a few young, a great many in their 30s and 40s, all shapes and complexions, all there to get in on the energy of the festival, contributing and feeding from it. When he arrived, Philip jumped right into the action and began comparing it to the great medieval trade fairs. Nearly everyone who came to Prague wondered what would become of this. It seemed unlikely that it would last for a long time. The rulers would have to stop it, once they really understood what was happening. But at least the rulers were slow and it could be many months before they moved adequately. One of the interesting things about the spontaneous festival was that it began to spawn a great many mini-festivals. One group left Prague for Budapest and began to work with the musicians there. Some set up concert tours, others made recordings, and some worked on film scores. Another group went to Estonia, where opportunities beckoned. Some to the other places in Europe, some to Asia, and others to New Zealand. But all of them went to the next place for some reason, and usually planning to move again within a year or so. And these were not just single people. Married couples and couples with children were very well respected. What better education, many of the parents would say, than to live and work around the world? There were close, interconnected families. Parents deeply involved in their children's lives and educations, and the children deeply involved in their parents' lives and work. They functioned very well, and the children were unusually healthy. By midsummer, the Prague Spring Festival was winding down. Some of the Gamma stayed, but most moved on. The experiment had been a success, and it was now widely known how wonderful such events could be. By late summer, there were at least four similar festivals in Helsinki, Tallinn, Sydney, and Bangkok.